Thank you, John, and welcome everyone. As John said, we are going to explore tonight a subject that I think is interesting for many people who are in the spiritual path or that are looking for a spiritual life, and that is not necessarily well understood, as we are going to see, because it's quite complex. Let us start with a little of history. When the Theosophical Society was founded in 1875, the view of human beings was mainly based on the Judeo-Christian tradition or the scientific view that was beginning to be very influential at the time. So in the Judeo-Christian tradition, the idea of a human being, for the most part, was that we are limited beings, we were created by God, we have intrinsic flaws, you know, the original sin. And in several branches of Christianity, the view was that we cannot even attain salvation by our own efforts, by our own exertion. We depend on God, whether God decides to give us the grace so that we can be saved. And our efforts matter very little, if anything. So that view of human beings was quite limited in the sense of what we could do. Of course, there is the mystical tradition that some people knew about, and some mystics had these gifts from God that were extraordinary powers, but they were not regarded as part of the human being. They were regarded, as I said, as gifts that God bestowed on some chosen ones. Or on the other hand, they could be gifts given by Satan through witchcraft. So whatever was abnormal, it was not natural. It was something that came from another source. And so that was more or less a view. And then, of course, the scientific view in the 19th century was very, very materialistic. And the idea was that we were only fleshy machines, and this is all we were, and there was nothing hidden, nothing potential more than our intelligence and our physical senses. So that was more or less a view, especially in the West. We didn't know anything about yoga or meditation or enlightenment at the time. Then there was a third group of people that were part of the spiritualistic movement. The spiritualistic movement was quite successful among the people who were not, that didn't feel in tune with either religion or science completely. And the idea there is that because in the seances, there was thought to be some spirit that would produce certain phenomena, certain psychic phenomena, things that could not be explained either by science or religion. Well, probably religion would say that is something that came from Satan. Now, the idea is that the theory was that when we die, we become spirits, and as spirits, we are endowed with a lot of powers that were not there while we were alive. So there were all these psychic phenomena associated with this, with some of the seances, and they came from the spirits. Now, when Madame Blavatsky, who was one of the founders of the Theosophical Society, came to the West, she had been trained in the East, and one of her aims was to bring that knowledge to the West. So when she came to the United States, she started to go to the seances and try to show that all these powers that were associated to the spirits were actually also a possibility in human beings, in living people. She would say there is no transformation, sudden transformation after we die. We all have those powers, but they are impeded in most of us by our physical senses, by our physical body. However, we could develop them. We know how to develop them. And she would go to the seances and reproduce many of the psychic phenomena that were supposed to be able to be performed only by spirits. Her first book, Isis Unveiled, is an attempt to show how all these things existed in history, but were not very well known in the West. And she draws a lot from India, where she lived and she knew many people there, and showed what the Hindu yogis could do that here in the West, except for a few scholars, as I said, we didn't know anything about. So when the Theosophical Society was founded, since the very beginning, one of its aims was to research into this, to investigate these latent powers that are in human beings. One of the reasons is that the population, the spiritual population, was with this idea of, you know, this lack of self-confidence, this idea that we are inherently limited. And unless we begin to recognize that there are potentialities in ourselves, there is no incentive to try to develop our potentialities. Of course, early in the history of the Western tradition, devotion and faith and love were enough to draw a person to the spiritual path. But as science began to be more and more influential, religion began to lose all this power over people. So now they were in this kind of frame of mind that said we are very limited. From, you know, traditionally they thought that, and now science was demonstrating it. And Blavatsky wanted to show that the case was different. So since the very beginning, the Theosophical Society was interested in investigating into this. So for example, in 1878, when the aims of the organization were being framed, there was a phrase in a text that was written to say what the Theosophical Society was about, that said, human beings, having inherited the nature of the cause of his own creation, must possess in his inner psychical self this creative power in lesser degree. He should therefore study to develop his latent powers. The aims of the Theosophical Society were reframed during a number of years at the beginning of the organization, and this particular aim took its final form, the same that we have now, with the following phrasing. This is the third aim of the Theosophical Society that says, to investigate and explain laws of nature and the powers latent in man. So this was the beginning of a more or less systematic study about these powers, but not in a scientific way. Theosophy has an interesting relationship with science. On one hand, regard science as an ally, because as science evolves, it will prove certain aspects, or that is what is normally thought in the Theosophical tradition, it will prove some aspects of the ancient wisdom that the Theosophical Society is trying to spread. But at the same time, it always recognized also the limitations, the intrinsic limitations in the scientific method, especially when we are dealing with spirituality, something that cannot be measured by physical machines. And as you may know, in science, anything that can be measured falls within the realm of science. If it cannot be measured, then by definition, it's outside the realm of science. So the Theosophical Society began to stimulate this study, but not in a scientific way, properly speaking. A few years later, another society was formed, the Society for Psychical Research. Members of the Theosophical Society were among the founding members and the early members of this society, and they wanted to try to research into these powers in a more scientific way. So they went to the seances and tried to research it. You know, Edison and many other important people were part of this. And this society still exists and has never been really successful in trying to prove these things from a scientific point of view. It's an intrinsically difficult task, as I said. But now this idea kept on rolling, and in the 30s, J.B. Rhind, this person that developed the concept of parapsychology, he was a professor in the Duke University in North Carolina, he framed the whole thing of the psychic powers, called them extrasensory perception, developed or began to use these cards that to try to measure, you know, different ESP. And he tried to do it in a very scientific way. Some things have come from this, but still the scientific community regards parapsychology as a pseudoscience. One of the reasons that they give is that there is no scientific theory to support or to explain this extrasensory perception, and that there are no experiments that can give reliable results. Now, saying that there is no scientific theory does not mean that there is no theory that can explain this. Science is unable to explain these things based on the limitations that are self-imposed in the scientific method. But there is a whole and very complex theory that explains how this can happen, how this takes place in human beings. This is what Blavatsky and early theosophists used to call the occult science. Occult in the sense of the science that deals with that is hidden, that is not seen. The Theosophical Society used the word occultism at the time in a quite different way that it is being used right now. And it was the organization that popularized the term among Western people. So there is a very complete and complex theory behind all this. Part of the work of the Theosophical Society was to provide the foundations for this science. As I said, this science is very complex, and we don't know the whole science. The idea that Blavatsky and others had was to provide the foundations of it so that we can have a general understanding of these matters. And this is important because ignorance always leads us to draw wrong conclusions that may lead us astray. For example, you know, the primitive human beings thought that the thunder was maybe a fight among the gods. They tried to explain a phenomena with the few elements that they had. In the same way, when there are some psychic or spiritual phenomena that happens to a person, often there is an assumption that is based on lack of information. And this assumption may be completely inaccurate and may lead a person in a wrong direction. So it is important to have a certain knowledge of the foundation of this so that we can make a rational assessment of what is going on. And what I'm going to try to do tonight is to share some of these foundations. So let us see what's the main theory behind this extrasensory perception. In the philosophical development in the West, there is usually this dualistic view of human beings. And by dualistic, I don't mean the opposite of the non-dual traditions that we know today. Dualistic in the sense of there are two main elements that compose the human being. Descartes, earlier, Plato would talk about the soul and the body, the world of ideas, archetypes, and the world of things. There were two dimensions, the material and the spiritual. Descartes would talk about the mind and body, or mind and matter, and these two were different principles with different qualities. And that's more or less what is at the background of Christianity and our normal view of human beings from a philosophical point of view. So the idea is that, let's say we have the soul, and then we have the body that we all perceive. This is the main idea. Now, how can the soul, which is immaterial, communicate with the body? This is a problem in philosophy. They call it the ghost in the machine. How can a ghost that is immaterial drive a machine or direct the motions of a machine that is material. So the Greeks, some of the Greeks, the Neoplatonists, developed the idea of intermediate principles that are a bridge. These principles are not completely immaterial and not completely material. So therefore, they can be affected by the immaterial and can affect the material. So this bridge is what in modern psychology we call the psyche, our psychological nature, our emotions and our thoughts. So the soul communicates to the body through our psychological nature. Now, the idea is that just as the body has senses, you know, there are physical senses and physical powers, we are transforming the world around. The animal kingdom cannot transform the world to a large extent. We human beings have the power to transform the world for good or for ill. So there are physical senses and there are physical powers that are the result of consciousness acting through the body. In the theosophical view, the psyche also has what we could call a subtle body. In the theosophical view, consciousness and matter, they are always together. So when we have a physical body, the soul expressing through the physical body, we have what we call the physical consciousness, the waking consciousness that we have right now. When the soul expresses through the psyche, the idea is that there are subtle bodies that are the vehicle of expression for the soul on this level, and the expression of the soul through the psychic bodies are thoughts, emotions, and what we call our psychology. And these bodies also have their own senses and also have their own powers. So these bodies, I don't want to go into detail, but they are the what is known today as the astral body, for example, or emotional body, and the mental body. They are fields that are around us through which we can actually perceive. The problem is that our attention is so focused on the physical body that we miss this subtler kind of perception. But as a person goes on in the spiritual path, it becomes to be more sensitive. And people who are, as I said, interested in spirituality and practicing, when they become more sensitive, they begin to perceive, for example, entering in a room or dealing with a person. Many times there is this intuitive perception of the atmosphere of the room or the atmosphere of the person, so to say. All that is obviously not perceived through the senses. It's perceived through the subtle senses, if we want to call them. So what we call extrasensory perception is a perception that belongs to the subtle bodies, especially, for the most part, to the astral body. So I will refer only to that one in particular. Now, the list of extrasensory perception that is given today, it's more or less systematic, or this knowledge is systematized to some extent. So we have, for example, telepathy, clairaudience, clairvoyance, remote viewing, precognition or retrocognition, astral projection, psychokinesis, etc. So all these belong to the subtle bodies that are part of ourselves. Now, they are extensions of the physical senses. For example, we have the sense of seeing, and we see on the physical plane. With physical eyes, we see physical objects. Now, there is a sense on the astral body that corresponds to the sense of seeing in the physical body. So when you awaken that sense in yourself, you start seeing the astral dimension. This dimension is what is called the aura, for example, in human beings. So you start seeing the aura. So you become a clairvoyant. This clairvoyance is the operation of the astral sight of the astral sense of sight, and just an extension of the physical, as I said. Same with the clairaudient people. They can listen to these astral sounds. And then if you have astral projection, for example, we can move physically from here to there, but we can also leave the body and move around the body. These are the out-of-body experiences. Well, these people are becoming aware on the subtle body, and that's why they can see the physical body down there. And then we have the precognition to see what is coming, or the retrocognition, the memory, or the remote view in seeing what happens in other places. And that has to do, again, with sight or with a kind of memory that sometimes is called the Akashic records, the ability to see the record of events that happened in nature. Everything that happens is impressed on what Blavatsky called the astral light. And then you can see it as a kind of movie, if you know how to develop that. So I don't want to go into details, but the idea is that all these psychic powers are the functioning of the senses of these subtle bodies, especially the astral body, and that they are coming through the brain to the physical consciousness of the person. Because when we go to sleep, we are all aware on the subtle bodies. And many people may be perceiving a lot of things, but then there is not necessarily a connection between the memory at the level of the psyche and the memory at the level of the body. There are some, let's say, channels that connect consciousness. If we want to bring the memory of these powers, a link has to be created. If we have time, I'll talk about that. So that's more or less a general idea of where this extrasensory perception comes from. Now let us explore, taking this into account, let us explore some of the methods of psychic development. Now, of course, as I said, all these methods are well known in India, and here in the West, we are learning about some of them. When I say in India, not only in India, no, in the Eastern tradition. Now, for example, there is a sage, an Indian sage, that is called Patanjali, and he organized the system of yoga into a system that is usually known as Raja Yoga. Raja means royal, kingly. And he designed a series of aphorisms that are called sutras in Sanskrit, where he explained the theory and practice of yoga. So in one of the aphorisms, these yoga sutras have four books or four chapters. And in the fourth one, at the beginning of the fourth one, Patanjali talks about the development of these powers, which in Sanskrit are called siddhis. Means power or attainment. So he says, these psychic powers, the siddhis, may be attained through birth, through the use of herbs, through mantras, self-discipline, or samadhi. So birth, herbs, mantras, self-discipline, or samadhi. Samadhi, let's say meditation. He explains a whole, in the third book, the whole science of samadhi, but let's say meditation. Now, so let us explore a little about this. Now, probably to understand how these things work, one of the basic principles is that for the psyche or the psychic powers or this extrasensory perception to express through the physical body has to be, or the activity of the physical body has to be lessened, has to be stopped as much as possible. It's like if you are, you know, the typical example, if you are trying to hear something that is subtle, you have to keep quiet. If you are talking, your talking will not allow you to perceive this more faint sound. So if the attention is completely immersed in the physical senses and sensations, it's very difficult to perceive this other subtler kind of perception. So by whatever means you can produce a lessening in the activity of the physical senses, you can induce or help the perception of the psychic senses. So for example, the first thing that he says is through birth. That means this is based on the theory of reincarnation, and there is a continuity from life to life. If we try to develop something in one particular life, when we take a new body, that new body will have a tendency to reproduce the same that we were working on. So after several incarnations in which a person is trying to develop in this direction, he or she may be born with a body that is more naturally sensitive to all this. The problem is that many times this body is unhealthy and out of balance or very irritable at the level of the nervous system. And we are going to see why. There is a reason why this happens. Now, that's one of the ways. The other way, he says, is through the use of herbs, you know, through the use of drugs. Now in the West, we have developed a whole science of that. Now, Vyasa, who was another Indian sage, who is thought to have written the Vedas, which are a very important spiritual literature in Hinduism. Vyasa, commenting on Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, he says that the use of drugs to produce psychic powers is only used by the asuras. The word suras in Sanskrit means gods. So asuras means the opposite to gods. Normally it refers to demons of all kinds, or it can refer to people who are treading that path. We could translate it to, in Christian terms, to people who are sinful, who are using methods that are not the right methods. So Vyasa strongly disregards the use of herbs to produce psychic powers. Why? There are some reasons. One of the ways in which the use of drugs stimulate the perception of this extrasensory perception is because in the brain there are two glands. One is the pineal gland and the other is the pituitary gland. So these two glands, when they are the bridge in the brain to receive the extrasensory perception. What the drugs do is to stimulate these two glands, and then stimulating them, it forces the glands to be open to this perception. Now, the problem is that when we push these glands to this kind of activity for which they are not naturally developed, we begin to damage those glands. And when their activity is disrupted, then we close the door to any influence from our spiritual nature because they don't work anymore and they cannot pass to the physical consciousness the influence from the spiritual nature. Also, the drugs can only produce an astral perception of the lower aspects of the astral plane. The astral plane is a whole universe, just as the physical is. And the lower aspects are related to the lower emotions in human beings, in animals, and the higher aspects are related to things that are closer to love and harmony and compassion. So, for example, Annie Besant, who was a second international president of the TS and was a clairvoyant, she says that the drugs bring again into physical consciousness indiscriminate impressions from the astral world. These come generally from the lower part of the plane, in which are aggregated all the astral matter concerned with exciting the lower passions and impulses. Sometimes they come from slightly higher regions of sensuous delight, but these are scarcely better than the others. So, you know, typically the experience of the use of drug, if it is not terrifying, is an experience of delight, sensual delight, you know, and pleasure and all these lights and this and that.
In the West, we are very tied to the senses. We tend to regard that something that is that produces a pleasant sensation or an exciting vision is therefore good, is therefore spiritual. It's completely different in the East or even in the West in the religious tradition. The senses were always suspected. So what Annie Besant says is that even if they don't actually stimulate the lower aspects of ourselves, they lead us to a part of the astral plane that is merely sensual and is not spiritual per se. So there are a few other reasons, but I'm not going to go into them. But this is why in Vyasa said that these are methods that the asuras practice. People who don't care about their communication with the spiritual nature, and people who care about stimulating the lower nature and the sensual aspect. So the next method that Patanjali describes is by mantras, the use of mantras. Now, this belongs to a whole group of methods that are based in producing a kind of self-hypnosis. You know, if you repeat a stimulus constantly in a regular way, you produce a kind of a state that is where our mind and our senses are dormant, are dulled. So when you repeat mantras constantly and rhythmically, and sometimes even the body, you know, is brought into the rhythm, that of course produces a pleasant sensation. And it could be okay if it is a preliminary practice to calm down the mind and go beyond that. But if it is used as a main process, it produces a state of hypnosis. And we are going to see what that leads to. But it produces, as I said, you know, by those means you stop the functioning of the brain so that subtler perceptions can come to the brain. Remember that we said the basic attempt that you are making is at silencing the physical body and the physical senses. So this can produce that. And there are other methods to watch intently a flame, for example, or a dark spot in a white background. When you watch without, you know, blinking very intently, again, the constant stimulation and changing stimulation begins to produce this dormancy in the nerves, in the eye, and they little by little go to the brain, and then the brain falls into a kind of hypnosis. So again, the brain is quiet, and there may be some perceptions. Or even the whirling that some Sufis do, not so much Sufis, I would say their dervishes, that also produce a kind of self-hypnosis. Now, of course, the use of mantras and the use of all these methods has a correct application too. For example, Patanjali, when talking about mantras, he says that the repetition should be made with meditation on the meaning of the mantra. So he didn't recommend this mechanical and constant repetition, but he said, repeat the mantra and meditate on the meaning. Try to keep the clarity of your mind and try to stimulate the understanding. And that is always a safeguard in meditation. As long as you keep your clarity, your understanding, your clear consciousness, then you won't fall into some alternative routes. We are going to see the effect of that. So then then austerities, the Sanskrit word that Patanjali uses is tapas. This means something like burning. And tapas is sometimes is translated as self-mortification. Another principle by which you can develop or you can perceive these extrasensory things is by putting pressure on the nerves, pressure, tension, straining on the nerves, make them vibrate in a higher way that they may be able to perceive higher things. So sometimes people in the agony of suffering, they see God or they hear the voice of something. And many times the agony of the suffering made them open to something else. or but that may also produce hysteria. So the problem with these the methods that induce a lot of tension is that if the person is not strong enough, healthy enough, they can produce a breakdown at the nervous level. So anything that induces a tension will tend to make the nerves more susceptible to psychic aspects. So this is why some lines of spirituality, they do a lot of penances or they fast in an extreme way, or they deprive themselves from sleeping, or they do physical things that produce a lot of exertion and tension, and they do develop some psychic powers. Now, the problem is that with all these methods, you are producing one of two things, or maybe both. The ones that tend to produce this hypnosis make the person fall into a trance. The trance liberates consciousness to be aware on the psychic planes. Now, since you are doing it in an artificial way, the problem is that when the person comes back to the trance, that person doesn't remember anything or didn't learn anything, only this vague sense of that blissful feeling, which is not too different to the one that we get when we go to sleep. We are very tired, go to sleep, have a sound sleep, and wake up, and we have this feeling of well-being. Just because our consciousness was on the astral plane and the physical body rested. So in a trance, something similar happens. And from a spiritual point of view, it doesn't bring any particular wisdom. If you can enter in this state of, which is called samadhi by Patanjali, this state, and we are going to see that later, where the mind is quiet, but not artificially quiet, is quiet but responsive, then the experiences on the inner planes can be impressed on the brain. But when you just put it to sleep, that doesn't bring anything in particular from a spiritual point of view. So that's one of the effects. And the other effect is that on the astral body, let's say, you know, let's suppose this is the aura. On the astral body, you have the physical body within the aura. And each sense, let's suppose the sense of sight, we have the physical body. And around the physical body, there is like this astral counterpart. You know, every part of our body has also its astral aspect. So when you do things like watching intently a flame or a dot, you begin to stimulate the astral aspect around the physical eye. Now the purpose, so let's say those are like astral sense centers. So what's the natural function of these astral sense centers? We have the soul, the origin or the source of consciousness, and in order to communicate with the eye and from the eye to the soul, the vibrations have to be transformed and into a kind that the soul can perceive, the immaterial soul can perceive. So when the eye perceives something physically, those vibrations affect the astral aspect of the eye, and those vibrations, another level, the mental, but it's all part of the subtle bodies, and then the subtle bodies affect the soul. So the natural function of the centers, these astral sense centers, is to be a bridge, not to be an organ of perception on the astral plane. Now, if you develop them, you can use them to see on the astral plane, but since they were not intended for that, the clairvoyance that you can get is very limited, quite confused. It's not, you are using something that it was not meant for that. The real organs of seeing on the astral plane, if we want to call it in that way, are the chakras, what we know as the chakras. These are the true astral senses. Now, of course, again, there are physical chakras or plexuses that science knows about. Then there are a little subtler chakras that in theosophy are called the etheric chakras. And then there are the astral chakras. If you want to develop, as I said, some psychic perception, you have to develop the astral chakras and the etheric chakras. What we know in the literature in general are the etheric chakras. So by the methods that we said, that we explore, you don't develop the chakras. You are developing this counterpart, and therefore the results are not satisfactory. And of course, if you practice this too much, you can damage your sight and everything. So let me see, Patanjali. Yeah, we cover most of it. With pranayama also, you can use pranayama is, you know, manipulating your breathing. It's another way of putting tension in the senses. There are some techniques of yoga where through pranayama, a lot of pressure is put at the level of the ears. And again, the person hears spiritually sounds, but it's just a result of the tension on the ears. So the only method that Patanjali recommends is the one on meditation, through meditation. So he said through birth, and that's beyond what you can do. I mean, whatever you do now will be reflected in the future. But through birth, the use of herbs, mantras, these tapas, or samadhi, meditation. So that's the only way that I don't even know that he recommends, as we are going to see, but he says, don't touch the other methods. You know, this method is healthier. It's a method that won't produce all these side effects. Now, through meditation, then we can meditate on the chakras, we can meditate on different centers. And again, if you see in Patanjali, another text of yoga, all these methods also have their dangers. In India, these methods come from India. Everything that we study today come from India or the East. And in India, traditionally, you would do all these meditations only when you had a guru to guide you. Now, this guru, there is a whole description of what a real guru is, a real teacher is. This guru has to be morally spiritual, a moral person, has to be clairvoyant, because when we start manipulating all these centers, you don't see what is going on. And you need somebody to see, and to see, this is a whole science, and you need somebody that will help you and correct this, correct that, put your attention here or there, stop doing this, do that. It's a whole science. So they needed a guru that was clairvoyant, those who wanted to develop this, and that went through this process and knew what he was talking about. Now in the West, we learn it from books, we learn it from people who learn them from books and who make money out of it. And in most cases, they don't know what they are talking about. And you know, and the books that were written, they are full of what are called veils, full of misleading aspects, because they knew, the gurus knew the intrinsic dangers in this, and they didn't want people, regular people, to mess with this. You know, in the East also, the guru would put the disciple to test to see if the disciple was really ready for that, and then would prescribe a life of purification and discipline so that the disciple could do this without any risk. Here in the West, the more people, the better, more money, and you know, nothing about the ability that the person may have or the kind of life. If we are in the middle of an active life, opening up to more vibrations is usually a problem. And here in the TS, unfortunately, we see it a lot. We see it a lot, people coming and trying, asking us for help, because they are, you know, obsessed by entities, or they awaken Kundalini and it's ruining their lives. Or we have a lot of stories. And Michelle used to work here, my wife used to work here in the information department, and we had almost every month a person with some problem because of doing all this. There are some other negative effects, even if, you know, and this is like anything else. There are people who smoke their whole lives, and they don't die of cancer. The smoking didn't do anything to them. So some people may practice all this and nothing happened. Fortunately, in the West, we tend to be not very serious. So the meditations that we do on this are feeble, and they are not going to produce anything, neither good nor bad. That's a protection. But if you are really intent on this, it can produce some problems. But besides that, Oh, let me see. Oh, I was talking about that in these books, many times there are veils. So when Patanjali says, for example, to develop this power, concentrate in the root of the tongue. It's not that you have to concentrate in the root of the tongue. What that point meant is the pituitary gland. And the gurus would tell this to the disciple. But they didn't want people, if you meditate on the tongue, nothing will happen. And it was a protection that they put. So many of the things that you read from the books are misleading. They are not the real science. That they were very protective about all that. It's just you don't want a kid to use, you know, gunpowder. So you try not to put it in the hands of those who are inexperienced. But Anani Besant, who was, as I said, clairvoyant, she talking about this, she says that there are some instructions to meditate on the navel. And she says, this really means the solar plexus, one of the chakras, for there is a close connection between the two. But to meditate on that is to incur in the danger of a serious nervous disorder, almost impossible to cure. And this is what happens if, when we mess up things on the subtle bodies, they can be dragged for several lives until they can come back in to a healthy state. But even leaving that aside, I remember in the TS I had a friend, and she was going to acupuncture, and accidentally they touched something, and she developed clairvoyance. And at the beginning it was fun, you know, she started seeing things. But then it began to be a really, really pressure on her, and she was really disturbed by this. And eventually it faded away, and she lost the clairvoyance, and she was really happy. And there is a phrase talking about this by Leadbeater. Leadbeater, again, was a member of the TS, probably one of the greatest clairvoyants in the 20th century. Most of the New Age started using his researches about all this. And he says, yet, after all, if those who are earnestly desire clairvoyance, who so earnestly desire clairvoyance, could possess it temporarily for a day or even an hour, it is far from certain that they would choose to retain the gift. True, it opens before them new worlds of study, new powers of usefulness, and for this latter reason, most of us feel it worthwhile. He was a clairvoyant. But it should be remembered that for one whose duty still calls him to live in the world, it is by no means an unmixed blessing. Upon one in whom that vision is opened, the sorrow and misery, the evil and the greed of the world press as an ever-present burden until in the earlier days of this knowledge, he often feels inclined to echo the passionate adjuration contained in the lines of Schiller. Schiller was a poet that says, why hast thou cast me thus into the town of the ever-blind to proclaim thine oracle with the open sense? What profits it to lift the veil where the near darkness threatens? Only ignorance is life. This knowledge is death. Take back this sad, clear sightedness. Take from mine eyes this cruel light. It is horrible to be the mortal channel of your truth. So the idea is, you start being very sensitive to everything that is in the world, the good things and the bad things. And unfortunately, at this period of evolution, as we know, there is a lot of bad things, bad feelings in people. And you start feeling it as if they were yours. When you become, you don't know why this hate is in you. For all you know, it's yours, but it may be of the person that is next to you. But you reproduce it, you feel it, you perceive it. So for this reason, before a person develops this, has to attain equanimity, has to attain detachment, and all this. Now, when we see all this, we say, what's the purpose then? Because it's not a very, encouraging picture. To develop psychic power seems to be something that is negative. Now, there are several things to be explored here. First, that what most people are looking for in developing psychic powers is to obtain things that cannot be given by psychic powers. Now, psychic powers are not the only powers or extrasensory powers we have. As we said, there is a physical dimension of the universe, which we all are aware of this. There is a psychic dimension that we have been talking about, and there is also a spiritual dimension, the dimension where the soul resides. And there are the same way that there are physical powers and senses, there are psychic powers and senses, the soul also has its own powers. Now, what are the powers of the soul? The powers of the soul are the spiritual powers, which is what really we are really looking for, or most of us. Spiritual powers are wisdom, compassion, love, peace, joy. All these are things that come from the soul. These things will change our life. Not having a psychic power, not being able to see auras or to hear astral bells or to travel somewhere. All those things may be fun, but they are not going to change your life. The ones that change our life are the spiritual powers. And in the theosophical tradition and also in the tradition of Raja Yoga, the idea is that the natural development in evolution is to develop first the spiritual powers, and then the spiritual powers will naturally develop the psychic powers. Now, why would you want to develop psychic powers? The idea is, especially in the theosophical tradition, there is a strong emphasis on trying to help humanity, to be of service to humanity, with whatever powers we have. You know, we may have a lot of money and spend it for our enjoyment, or we may spend part of that money to help others. We may have a lot of intelligence and use it to make a career and, again, a lot of money or fame, or we can use that intelligence to help others, or time, or whatever skill we have, we can use it to help others, or we can use it in a selfish way. So for a spiritual person, people who have a psychic ability and they are spiritual, they usually can have more power to help people around than with only having the physical powers. So the point of view is that we first develop the spiritual powers, and then the spiritual powers will develop the psychic powers, and that person will be mature to handle them without any of these dangers, and will be able to use them in an altruistic way and not in a selfish way. And that is actually the, as I said, at least from the theosophical point of view, the natural development. So Patanjali, after he describes all the siddhis, all the psychic powers, then he says that these psychic powers, let me get the quote here. Patanjali says in the third book, in the Sutra 38, these siddhis resulting from meditation are obstacles to samadhi, to this spiritual state, but appear to be attainments or powers to the outgoing or worldly mind. So for those who are tied to the senses, they are, you know, they naturally want to develop psychic powers because they are an extension of the senses. That is what he calls the worldly mind. And most of us don't know better because all these things are advertised as being spiritual. But what he says is that they become obstacles for spiritual vision, spiritual wisdom, spiritual intuition. And that's something recognized even with many of the mystics. Many of the mystics would say that these powers that would awaken in them were put there by Satan to lead them astray. Because the idea is to try to go beyond any senses, whether physical or psychic, and to unite with the spirit, to unite with God, to unite with the divine. If you begin to develop all these psychic powers and you become entertained and start, you know, you get stuck in this realm when the real aim of any mystic or spiritual person is to go beyond and to get in touch with the divine and to develop all these things. So the development of the psychic powers becomes an obstacle for that. Just as if, you know, we go to meditate, and what we try to do is to shut off all the stimulus. You know, we don't want to listen to the car or to this or that. But then when we start listening to astral bells, then we think that's spiritual. That's the same. It's a distraction, just as a physical one. So in the Theosophical Society, the emphasis is on the spiritual development. And this spiritual development, as it progresses, it will naturally make the body and the psyche more sensitive and more united, and will naturally develop the psychic powers. And with this I'm finishing. The methods for spiritual development are the methods that we normally talk about, you know, meditation and study and service. We give many lectures about them, so I don't have time to go through them now. But the idea is that the spiritual path, as it is laid down by traditional religious and spiritual movements, has the aim of developing the spiritual powers, which are the ones that are going to really change our life. Then once we develop that, as I said, I don't want to say that the psychic powers are wrong. They, as anything in nature, may produce difficulties when they are tried to develop artificially or out of sequence before the time is ripe. So that's what I wanted to share tonight with you. Now, as usual, if there are any questions or comments, we can discuss anything.
I often meditate, and when I want to do something helpful for people, I try to visualize them surrounded by a white light of spiritual protection. But it seems to take a lot of emotional and spiritual energy, and I can't really hold that for very long. Is there anything in writing from Patanjali or someone similar that can help guide you through developing some of this spiritual power to make it more effective?
Yes, there is the idea in yoga, the idea of brahmacharya, which usually is translated as celibacy, but it means much more than that. The idea of brahmacharya is to try to live in a way where we don't waste energy. So anything you do it in a healthy and balanced way. Even sexual relationships, that's fine. But if they become, you know, promiscuous or a mere source of pleasure, then you are wasting your energy. But not only with that, in our whole life. So we have very little energy left for the spiritual work. So part of the preliminary training before the person begins to work on these levels is to reduce the outgoing energy and the spending of energy. So when you try to concentrate your mind, you are spending or you are using a lot of energy, and you will see that if you really try hard, you will be tired. When you are trying to send good thoughts also, you are always using energy. And it's a good way of using energy. You are trying to use energy to help other people. But at the same time, you have to work on your spiritual life following, you know, these different traditions that have stood the test of time. And little by little, as your emotions become quieter, your mind becomes quieter, there is a whole lot more energy that you have for all this work.
You said about developing the spiritual powers of the soul. One of the ways to do it, you said it was through meditation, obviously, and then birth, correct? Mm-hmm. Birth. Do you see any relation, like, to develop birth, but if you do want to achieve meditation, like in this correlation of birth and death? I know they're opposing things, but they're very similar. And do you find any correlation, like when a child is inside the mother, that their physical eyes are closed, but the senses that they can sense are only light and sound? And do you see any correlation with that, with the eyes and, you know, upon birth, your physical eyes open, but your third eye closes. Mm-hmm. But like you said, experiencing birth in reverse, kind of like the death experience, which is the goal of meditation, I think. Is that, am I correct or am I wrong? Kind of like, you know, dulling the senses, dulling the thought impulses, and reaching that kind of almost a flatline state. Do you find any relation, like
The idea
death
of birth
experience in reverse?
Yeah, the idea of birth was in Patanjali was related to the psychic powers, but can also be related to the spiritual powers in the sense that whatever we do in one life tends to be repeated in the next. So people who work on trying to develop the psychic aspects, especially through these techniques that tend to put a lot of pressure on the body, in the next life, they may have a body that is more sensitive to all these things. But as I said, they are usually unhealthy because they are sensitive because they have a lot of pressure or tension. It's like when you tense a cord to play an instrument, you can do it too much. So you can inherit a body that has psychic tendencies, but also if they were not developed from the spiritual, in the natural way, from the spiritual to the psychic, they will tend to be unbalanced. Or you can inherit a tendency towards spirituality and a body that is more receptive to all these powers of the soul. Now, yes, meditation in the sense is trying to do the opposite to what we do in birth, because during birth, the soul, after death, there are a series of processes, and then the soul comes back home, let's say, and then stays there. There are some processes, and then when the soul incarnates again, it engages in a process of materialization where all these powers are obscured by the senses. So meditation is like a coming back, a reversing that. But while with the methods that I talked at the beginning, this is done by force and in an artificial way, you know, trying to dull the brain. In the spiritual meditation, you train yourself, you train your mind to be quiet, but with the full consciousness, with all your volition, you know, it's a completely different thing. You get to the same, the brain is quiet, but one is without consciousness, the other is with the full awareness. So yes, by spiritual meditation, you do this regularly, gradually, and with your full consciousness.
Is that the idea behind going into a meditative state with a seed thought that you want to focus on, and then you try to remember that as you get yourself aligned?
Mm-hmm. Yes, there are different states of consciousness, let's say. All of us has our consciousness has a particular seat or a seat on one of these states. Suppose you are on the second state of consciousness. This is just symbolic. Now, when you try to become aware on the third stage of consciousness, you can do it by two means, as I said. You can stop artificially the seat of consciousness that allows you to be aware on this second stage. Then your consciousness will naturally jump to the next one. Or you can try to extend your consciousness to the next one without losing your awareness. Now, this method of extending your consciousness is more difficult, is slower, but once you establish yourself on the next level, that level stays with you in your daily life. That's part of you. This other state, you can only go into that state, you know, when you are meditating or applying this technique. It doesn't serve any purpose in daily life, and as I said, you don't bring much from there. So the idea is always to retain consciousness. Try to reach the highest level without losing consciousness. If you lose consciousness and fall into a trance, that is not good. I mean, and sometimes that happens because people who have practiced some of these methods in the past, because we don't know, you know, we know these things by trying them many times. People who have practiced that may have a tendency to fall into unconscious trances. So that person has to be very careful not to cling to awareness. A spiritual awareness, as spiritual as possible, as abstract as possible, but still awareness, not to let it go.
Mm-hmm. When you said, like, our body remembers, like, try to maintain a level of consciousness as opposed to going into a trance state, then you're not aware of what's going on. Now, you say when you reach a higher level of consciousness that we tend to stay at that level during our everyday, you know, mm-hmm. life and actions, you know, mm-hmm. be it going to work or doing a job. Is it because our physiology got a taste of that level of consciousness mm-hmm. while being conscious, and our body likes it, and that's why it likes to stay at that, mm-hmm. you
well,
know,
there,
at that
yeah,
level?
There is a whole process. At the beginning, we can reach it only in special moments, like when meditating. Then we come out of that, even if we retain that awareness, then it is very difficult to extend it into our daily life because the matter of our body and subtle bodies are used to working in a different way. So like with anything else, the body works by habits. So by making the effort of reaching that state of consciousness more frequently and making the effort to retain it, the body little by little gets used to be a vehicle of that kind of consciousness. But it is something gradual and requires effort, like with anything else, you know, any other skill that we want to acquire.
It has been a curiosity since I lived in New York about the third object, because people misinterpreted the third object as being not the psychic, but the intuitive aspect, because the intuition includes the psychic too. But one works together with both.
Yeah, the idea, I mean, as I said, like the psychic powers are the echo of the spiritual powers. If you go through the path of the Raja Yoga, which, you know, the theosophical approach is in tune with that, there are, generally speaking, two paths that sometimes have been characterized as the Raja Yoga and the Hatha Yoga. By Hatha, I don't mean just the asanas. The Hatha yogis in India, they did all these techniques that I talked about before. The Hatha yogis in India, they practice that. So the idea is to force from below to open up something above. That's the Hatha yoga in India, or to go from above and stimulate it from above. So in the path of Raja yoga, the psychic power are the echo or the, you know, the shadow of the spiritual power. So they come naturally together. So we don't need to differentiate them in the object.
I have one question from someone who sent it online. It seems as though a side effect and not an objective of both physical and spiritual practices.
Yes. I don't know if I would call it a side effect. I mean, from a certain point of view, yes. Now, they are necessary too in the course of evolution. They are part of what the full blown of a human being. Now, the thing is the order in which they are awakened and by what method. So they seem as a side effect because of the sequence, because the spiritual powers are first and then the psychic powers. But they have a purpose in themselves. Now, that purpose cannot be fulfilled when we try to force them beforehand or ahead of time. Now, some people are successful in developing these psychic powers, and even if they are not necessarily very mature spiritually, they may do some good about this. You know, it's just like anything in life. What I'm saying here is like the general rule, if you will, but then each case is different and particular. So I would say the psychic powers have a role, but it comes late after the spiritual powers.
One experience I've had, and other people I know, is a sort of, in terms of meditation and self-awareness, is a sense of peeling off the layers of an onion. You know, it's like as we get to know ourselves better, mm-hmm. We peel off more layers that have been put upon us and seem to come to greater apprehension of ourselves. Where does that type of activity fit into what you've described?
I didn't go into the methods of spiritual development, and I have given several lectures in the past on this, and they are available on the internet on our website. And the spiritual methods are basically that, you know. So the idea, our consciousness is normally focused on our physical body and then our emotions and our mind. And then we have to let go of the identification and begin to see like from above, if you want to put it this way, and let go the identification with the body, then with the emotions, then with the mind. And then as you become aware on the spiritual levels, you can relate to body, emotions, mind in a far wiser way and more healthily, and you know. So yeah, all that is part of the spiritual development that wasn't the focus of this. Now, something that I wanted to say, if you happen to have some psychic, you were born or you developed some psychic powers, that's fine. I mean, the from this point of view, the advice would be start working on the spiritual life. Start working on developing all this. And as you develop that will give you the poise, the power, the confidence to relate to your psychic sensitivity in a better way. So, you know, for many different reasons, we may have naturally some of these sensitivities, and it's fine. In some people, it's quite disturbing, but in many others, it's not. But I would say the safe way to go is stimulate this other part. And you will see how even the psychic sensitivity develops more in a more integrated way.